Well, it's great to be here with you this evening, this afternoon. I'll make sure we end this afternoon as well, too. Some of you are worried about that. Let me just introduce my wife. This is Maribel, my wife, and my son, who is hidden behind the piano, playing the viola. That was a viola, just in case you were thinking it was a violin. Just for the record, viola. So we've been ministering in Spain for 25 years. And I know, I say that sentence and I think, wait a minute, I think that's wrong. And I'm sure you were thinking the same thing, right? I'm sure you were thinking it must have been at least 40 by now that you know. We've been there for 25 years, and we went to Spain with a tiny baby in 1998. And at this point, we are returning on the 18th of May. Lord willing, we'll be returning, and once again returning just the two of us. So we have a married son who lives in Charlotte, and our big news is that they're expecting a baby, which turns us into, I'm still struggling to say it. I'll keep working on that. We have a married daughter who lives here in Greenville, and it's been great to spend this time here and be close to them as well. And then our youngest son, Daniel, will be a senior next year, and looking forward to working at the Wilds of New England this summer. And we're thrilled for him as he serves there this summer and then seeks God's direction for his future. Well, it's great to be here. We're not here to simply show you pictures or talk a lot about exotic cultural elements, talk about food. None of you are interested in food anyway. We all ate, so we don't need to do that. I'm here to preach the word in this afternoon, but I would like to just share a little bit about what we've done in the ministry in the last 25 years. We went to Spain initially just out of school, thinking perhaps maybe we could jump in and maybe help out in a ministry, get some experience. And so actually we went without missionary support. We went with the purpose of just being involved in a ministry. The Lord had slightly other plans for us, and after we'd been there for just a few months, the missionary that we were working with had to come back. And so for the last 25 years, we've worked in church planting, but without really missionary support from the United States. So I did end up starting to receive missionary support from my home church, which is Hampton Park here in town, and also from a church that we worked with in Anderson while we were living here in Greenville. But we've worked for these 25 years in church planting, and at the same time, I've taught classes at a university. It's a state university. Roughly, the actual figures are somewhere in the range of 26,000 students, but I do not teach all 26,000. That's the good news. But that's been an interesting opportunity over the years. There have been times where it's extremely stressful trying to juggle family, ministry, work. But God has always given us grace, and so as we go back and we continue on in that capacity, we're excited to get back into the ministry. We're excited because God gave us co-workers. We've been asking for co-workers for 25 years, and God finally answered that prayer. It was His time now, and that's part of the reason we're here right now, because we actually have co-workers who are covering the church while we are here. We've been here since we arrived on Christmas Day, in 2022, so about 5 months ago. Anyway, we've been here for this time and very excited as we go back and continue in the ministry, and happy to be able to share with you a little bit today from the Word, which is our ministry in Spain. But first of all, I wanted to do something with the kids today. So, kids, I want you to do me a favor. Can you come up here and sit with me up here? All right, hold on, wait a minute, because I'd better define kids, because otherwise I might get some big people up here too. All right, we better go with like elementary age and down. Can we do that? All right, where are my kids? Come on up here. Have a seat. First ones up, get the best seats in the house. That's the best seat in the house. All right. I wasn't quite sure what the best seat in the house was, so I was interested to see. All right, fantastic, you guys. What a great group. I love the colors. All right. Good. How are you guys doing? Everybody doing well? Let's see what ages do we have here. Who's the youngest? Who, you're the youngest?
Yeah, that's me,
Adele. Okay, Adele, how old are you?
1, 2, 3, 4.
4. All right, that's fantastic. All right, good. And so some of you, what we're going to talk about today, you're not going to be able to participate the same way. But others of you are going to be able to do it. So I've got a question for these kids here. My question is, how many of you know how to read? All right. Yeah, I know. That's the way life works. But you know what? It's going to come. So you hold on, and your day is coming. All right, so a lot of you know how to read. Was it hard to learn how to read? It was? So remember that, because I don't remember those things. You know, I don't remember what it was like to learn how to read. So if it was hard for you to learn to read, remember that fact. All right, I brought a book with me, and I'm going to need a volunteer who can help me read some pages out of this book. I have a volunteer. Anybody want to do it? You think you can do it? All right, great. Let me grab my book here. The great thing about this book is I actually worked on this book, so we don't have to ask for any author's permissions or anything. That's the great part about this. All right, I want you to just read some out of this book. We'll just go with this page here. All right, just read out nice and loud there. Yeah, just start here. You can start here. Wait, you said you knew how to read, right? Oh, okay. I mean, you know that letter, right? That's a D, yeah. All right, so yeah, you got it. You got it. Just go ahead and just take it away. All right. Yeah, you're doing a great job. Actually, yeah, that's good. What do you think about this? Is this kind of a strange book? It's not what you were expecting, was it? Oh, we got somebody who knows what's going on here. It's in Spanish. Wait a minute. I just did something really, really deceitful to you. What's your name?
Joshua.
Joshua's a great, great guy here, because he just took on an incredibly hard task, right? Because I gave him a book that wasn't written in English. So, does Joshua know how to read? Yes, of course Joshua knows how to read. But reading this is a different story, because it was cheating. It was in a different language. So even though the letters were the same letters you were familiar with, the actual information was harder to understand. How are we doing down here? I think I'll talk from down here for a while. That'll be good. You know, it's interesting because let's sit down. Yeah, great. Just sit down right there. You're doing fantastic. I like your yellow dress. All right, great. And that's a good spot for you to sit. Fantastic. All right, so when I asked him to read this, he read it. He actually did. He read it. Did you understand what you were reading? Hey, we need to sit on that. Let's sit on there. We're going to do better if we're just staying right there. Yeah. Yeah, right here on the carpet. We need to be on the carpet. Yeah. There we go. Right there. Thank you. Yeah, the shoes are fantastic. All right. So when we asked if he could read this, he said yes. Could he read it? Did you hear him read it? All right. How many of you think that he read what was on the page? How many of you think he read? All right, we got a pretty good majority here. Hey, have a seat here. All right, yeah, there we go, just like that. All right, let's just sit right there. All right, let me ask the same question out here. How many of you think that he read that page? Okay, we're not quite getting the same number of responses. Because actually, when we talk about reading, pronouncing the words that are written on the page, is that reading? If you read something but you didn't understand it, did you really read it? Yeah, you see the problem? It's a kind of an interesting issue, because reading is a lot more than just pronouncing the words on the page. It actually involves understanding the information that's written there. All right, so we're going to talk today, in just a minute, we're going to talk about a story in the Bible about somebody who was reading something and somebody asked him a question. Do you understand what you're reading? So let's just imagine that. You read the first couple words on this page, and I ask you, do you understand what you're reading? What do you think? What do you answer? No, I don't. So we're going to keep that in mind, and we're going to come back to that. But, you know, it's a really good thing to read the Bible. This is actually the Bible. This is the book of John. And it's a good thing to read the Bible. But you know what? Reading the Bible is not just about passing. Whoa. Yeah. It says Juan. That's the book of John. Reading the Bible is a lot more. Hey, all right. Here, come here. Let's do this. You want to come with me? You don't want to come with me? All right. Then you sit there. Or you do want to come with me. All right. Here, come with me. All right. So when you read the Bible, are you going to go with him? All right. He's a good-looking guy, too. All right. All right. Here we go. Yeah. Right here. So when you read the Bible, reading the Bible is not just about passing your eyes over the page. It's not just about recognizing words. When you read the Bible, the important thing is actually understanding what the Bible says. And you know what? God has given us people in our lives that can help us with that. God has given us your parents. They can help you to actually not just see words on the page, but actually understand it. God has given you teachers. Your teachers, that's their job, right? They can help you read things and understand them. And in fact, God has given you pastors in your church who can also help you understand what you're reading. And that is not just for kids. So you guys can go ahead and sit down. Thank you guys so much. You did fantastic. I think there was a lot of cake right after lunch. I think that's what we were experiencing there in some cases. Well, I would like to share with you today from chapter 8 of the book of Acts. Acts chapter 8. This is a story that I'm sure all of us know this story, but I want to come at it and look at it perhaps from a slightly different perspective. Acts chapter 8, but before we get into Acts, I wanted to first of all start off with a couple questions and a short story. I'm sure all of us have had that experience where we were trying to plan the perfect event. Maybe this could be a stretch. Maybe it was a work party. You know, you were in charge of putting together a work party, and you said last year's work party was a disaster. And if I'm going to do it this year, I'm going to think of every detail, and I'm going to plan it, and it's going to be perfect this year. All right, maybe it's your child's birthday that you're thinking of right now, where you planned this birthday party, and you had the perfect cake, you had the perfect event, you had the fire department show up, not to put out the fire, but just, you know, to demonstrate for kids what the firemen look like. All of those things, right? And there's something to be said about an event that is perfectly planned, an event where somebody has done all the detailed work to make something come off perfectly, and that's special. That's very special. But have you ever had one of those situations where there was something and it came off, and it came off completely perfectly, but it was totally unplanned? All right, so last summer, we came and we were visiting our kids and my parents, and I've for years now, I've wanted to go to the Bible Museum in Washington. I don't know if you guys have visited the Bible Museum in Washington, but I thought, I really want to go to the Bible Museum in Washington, but it's kind of complex when you live in Spain to make it to the Bible. So I worked this deal out. I told my parents, I said, okay, we're going to fly in. If you pick us up, we will drive you. This is the way I sell it to my parents. We will drive you to the Bible Museum in Washington so you can see it. My parents said, we've already seen it. I said, okay, well, I'll go with the new plan. So I said, you know, let's go together to the Bible Museum. Okay, perfect. So we got to the Bible Museum. Well, some of you may know my mother. My mother does calligraphy. And my mother was thrilled with the idea of going to the Bible Museum because there's a Hebrew scribe, and he actually writes in a Torah scroll, and you can watch him write. And my mother wanted to see the Hebrew scribe. So she mentioned it several times on the way up, you know, that, oh, I want to talk to the Hebrew scribe. So we got to the museum. And as we came in, we bought our tickets, and my mother asked the lady at the ticket station, she said, now where is the Hebrew scribe? And the lady at the ticket station said, today is Tuesday, he doesn't come on Tuesdays. And this was, yes, your reaction was the same as my mother's reaction, yes. And this was like very bad. And I said, you know, Mom, it's okay, you know, it's fine. She said, well, I really wanted to talk to him. I said, well, you know, Maybe you can come again some other time. So as we go, you know, we spend some time on the first floor, seeing some exhibitions. As we're getting in, we see a lady who works in the Bible Museum. And my mother goes straight for this lady and says, "Excuse me, do you know anything about the Hebrew scribe?" All right, so, okay, I'm 50 years old now, but I still have those moments, right, where your parents do stuff and you go. And the lady said, "No, he doesn't come on Tuesdays." And, you know, I'm there saying, "Mom, we already know this. You know, why did you ask?" So, you know, we're going throughout the day. We had lunch. We came back after lunch. We were up on the third floor. There's an eternal, you know, it take you forever to get through the third floor. But we're going through little by little. And my dad, I was actually looking at a Spanish Bible that's very, very rare. I was thrilled to be looking at it. And there was a man next to me who was, he was Israeli, and he's talking to his son in Hebrew. And, you know, that's kind of neat. I'm eavesdropping just a little bit, just, you know, looking and listening. And all of a sudden, my father appears out of nowhere and accosts this man and says, "Hey, do you know anything about Rabbi Moshe?" And now I'm doubly embarrassed because this is not somebody who works in the museum. This is just like a random person speaking Hebrew. And my dad is asking this person, and I'm like, Dad, we've gone through this. And the guy says, "I'm Rabbi Moshe." He says, "I don't normally come in on Tuesdays, but I had a friend who wanted to come see the museum, so I came today. I'll be over at the desk in just a few minutes. If you want to come, I'll be writing some Hebrew over there." My parents were thrilled. And I was kind of embarrassed because I thought, you know, I was about ready to reprimand my father in public for asking about this when we've already asked too many times already. But, you know, it was really interesting. It was as if God had specially set that situation up. And it wasn't that somebody worked it out. It wasn't that we got to the museum, found out he wasn't coming, and I made some phone calls, you know, because I have contacts with people, and I got Rabbi Moshe to show up at the museum. It wasn't about anybody organizing anything. It was one of those moments where you just say, that was a gift of God. God orchestrated a situation, and he did it better than anybody possibly could have done. Now, I want you to hold that thought for just a minute. And I want to go to Acts chapter 8, and I want to look at the story in Acts chapter 8 because it is a story of how God orchestrates situations in an incredibly amazing way. All right, we're just going to quickly give a little bit of an understanding of what's going on in this passage, and I'm going to have to do this. I never have done this before because I never used to wear glasses, but I've come to this terrible point in life where it's not that my eyes are failing me, it's that my arm isn't as long as it used to be. So in Acts chapter 8, where do we start here in the story? Well, if you're looking at your Bible, Acts chapter 8 starts with the situation dealing with Saul of Tarsus and his influence on the church. All right, so when you start the chapter, you see Saul and persecution is happening in the church. And what is the result of the persecution? Now I find myself, I need to get bifocals or something. All right. What happens? What's the result of the persecution? I'm so glad to see you doing the same thing. Thank you. You're encouraging me. So what happens because of this persecution? All right. We get scattering. Interestingly enough, the apostles are not the ones that scatter. It's kind of surprising because I would have expected, like, Peter would have been the one that they're going after. Peter would have been the first one out of there. But it's actually the believers that get out and the apostles stay put. And so as people start to scatter, we find out the main character in Acts chapter 8 is Philip. Now make sure we get the right Philip. This is not Philip the apostle. This is Philip the deacon. So if we go back and we find out when the deacons were elected, Philip is one of the men who was elected. And so as the believers scatter, Philip spreads out. He goes out from Jerusalem. And where does he go? He goes to Samaria. Now, that's pretty random, right? Because that was not a normal place to go if you were Jewish. If you were Jewish and saying, okay, I need to get out of Jerusalem, Samaria was not your number one destination. because Jews just didn't go to Samaria. But Philip goes to Samaria. And what does Philip do in Samaria? What does he do? He starts preaching. And as he's preaching, all of a sudden, there is a revival that happens. People start reacting to his preaching. There's healing happening. People are being baptized. And this is an incredible story. Now, there's another story in the middle that sort of gets our focus off of Philip for a minute. And we see this guy, Simon. And we're not going to look at Simon today. We're not as interested in Simon's story. But Simon is a great story and a great lesson for us to learn, definitely. But as we look at Philip, Philip is in I'm going to call this a sweet spot. I don't normally use that language, but I think that's the right term, right? Philip is kind of like in a place where you say, this is exactly where I would like to be. I mean, I would love to be in a situation where God is working, you're seeing people come to Christ, baptisms. I mean, this is a great moment to experience. And right in the middle of this story, we all of a sudden read something in verse 26. In verse 26, we read, "Now, an angel of the Lord said to Philip," all right, so an angel says to Philip, in the middle of the revival in Samaria, what the angel says, "Philip, I want you to take an even greater role in this revival. I want you to write a book. I want you to have a podcast." I mean, this would be something we might expect, right, in this scenario. But that's not what the angel says. The angel says, rise and go. Those two words, three, if we count the conjunction. Rise, go. Those words actually sort of should echo through our mind and take us back to the Old Testament. Anybody remember in the Old Testament a moment when God said, "Get up and go"? He did it several times. We can actually find this in Abraham. God tells Abraham, "Get up and go." And what does Abraham do? He gets up and he goes. Same thing happens with Balaam. All right, Balaam's a little stranger case. Balaam definitely wanted to go because he was thinking about the money he was going to get at the end of going. So he was going for the wrong motives. But God finally tells him, "Okay, if they ask you again, get up and go." And they asked him again, and there was Balaam. He got up and he went with them. All right, so we see several of these stories. In fact, Elijah, God tells Elijah, "Get up and go." And he sends him to this widow's house where he will be hidden during this famine. But I'm guessing that if you were thinking of a passage in the Old Testament where there was a get up and go moment, you weren't thinking of any of the characters that I just mentioned. Anybody have the name in mind where we see this get up and go command? Somebody? Jonah. In fact, you have it twice in the book. You have it in chapter 1, verse 2, and then chapter 3 starts a new cycle in the book, and it's the exact same words from the first chapter. Get up and go. And what did Jonah do? Jonah got up. We're good so far. But he didn't go. He fled. He fled from the presence of God. Why did Jonah do that? I mean, why would you actually run away from what God's telling you to do? Well, Jonah actually tells us. I'm not sure that really what he says is the actual truth. But he tells us, he says, "I didn't want to come because I knew, God, that you were going to be gracious to these people. That's why I didn't want to come. That's why I fled in the first place." But basically, it comes down to the fact that Jonah wasn't interested in really doing what God wanted him to do. Jonah's will and God's will came into direct conflict. And therefore, when God said, "Get up and go," he got up and left. And so, if we take that phrase and we put it in this context, God comes to Philip and says, "Philip, you're in the middle of a revival. God is working, doing amazing things. I want you to get up and go. Get out of here. Leave." And I just imagine Philip, you know, sort of dealing with this command. Looking at this command and saying, Really? Now? I mean, this is the place where I've desired to be, right? Your word is working. Why would I leave at this point? But you know what? Sometimes God asks us to obey Him, even in moments when it seems like everything is going really, really well. Moments when it seems like we've got it all. Like we're in the perfect situation. Like I just want this to keep going forever. I never want it to end. What if God came to us and said, get up and go? Now, please don't misunderstand me. I am not in the least trying to suggest that God is some sort of killjoy. Like He doesn't want us to be happy. Like the minute we start being happy, God says, oh, I better move him, get him out of here. You know, he's enjoying himself too much. It's not about that. In fact, I think God often places us in a place where really He gives us the desires of our hearts sometimes, and He wants us to enjoy that. I love that passage in 1 Timothy where it says, God has given us all things that we might enjoy them. And certainly, this is not saying that God is trying to somehow take joy away from us. But sometimes, we find ourselves in a moment where we say, this is great. And at times, God says, yes, it has been great, but I want you to go. And the question is, are we willing? Are we willing to obey without selfishness? You see, that's the issue here, right? Because why would Philip want to stay where he was? I mean, certainly you could say, well, I'm serving God. But there's another part of it that says, yes, but I really enjoy serving God in this particular place, in this particular moment, and I really want to stay here. But sometimes God is calling us to say no to self, to say no to some of those desires of the flesh, and truly be obedient to His will, even if it would just be fantastic if we could just stay where we are for a little bit longer. So I look at this story, and the first thing I notice is this principle of obedience, even in the case of selfishness, in the case of maybe a personal desire, something that we might really think, look at our own comfort and say, no, I really want to stay where I am. And I look at this story and I think, you know, sometimes God calls us outside of our own comfort zone and He wants us to obey Him. Are we willing to truly obey God? But the story continues. It's not just get up and go. God actually says some interesting things to Philip here. All right, so it says, rise and go toward the south. How are we doing with our cardinal directions here? I am completely lost. Which way is north? Anybody know? North. All right, fantastic. Go to the south. That's pretty generic. I mean, there's a lot that's going on in the south over there. I mean, I don't know where that is. I mean, I know I've got a direction, so that's not real specific. Let's see if we get any more specific information. To the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. Is that a specific location? Yes and no. I mean, imagine for a minute I say, arise and go down to I-85, the road that goes from Charlotte to Atlanta. Where are you supposed to go? I-85 is pretty long. There's a lot of going. I mean, how would Philip know that he's where he's supposed to be? I mean, he's got a direction. He's going south. He's got like a landmark, right? He's going for this road, okay? But there's one last phrase. I'm sure this is going to clinch it. This is a desert place. How do you know when you're in a desert place? You know, if God had said, go to mile marker 58. All right, so we could do that, right? Go to the city that's on the road between Jerusalem and Gaza. I mean, we could do that. But a deserted place in the middle of a highway. I mean, I look at this and I say, I mean, if I were Philip, I think I would be looking at this and saying, God, I mean, I don't mind obeying you, but frankly, I need more details here. I mean, I need to know a little bit more than what you've given me here. You know, God has given Philip information, but he hasn't really given him explanations. There's a difference, right? You've got information. You have enough information that you know the first step that you need to take. South. Here we go. Where are you going? I really don't know, but somewhere down there. Is this a strange moment biblically? Any other characters in the Bible that did something very similar? What's his name? Abraham. Go! Where? I'll show you when you get there. Am I going the right direction? I'll show you when you get there. I mean, amazing faith. The faith that Abraham displayed, and frankly, the faith that Philip is displaying here. Because Philip gets up and he goes. Now, it's not just about sometimes God calling us out of our comfort zone. Sometimes that comfort zone involves the amount of information that God gives us. Some of us are a little bit more on that side of the OCD scale. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand, all right? But some of us, I mean, we like to know every single detail. I remember when I was in high school, I worked on the high school yearbook. And so one of my jobs was to go around and talk to the different faculty members and set up a date for us to go into their classroom to shoot pictures of them in their element, which was a pretty easy job because most teachers were like, yeah, just come whenever. So we went whenever and we took pictures. But I remember the math teacher. I'll never forget the math teacher because I went to her office and I said, we need to come and take pictures of your class. And I was wondering what day we could come and, you know, take pictures. And she pulled out her desk calendar, and she said, what day were you thinking? And I said, well, next Wednesday would be good for us. And she said, no, I don't like my outfit that I'm going to be wearing that day. How about Thursday? Amazing. I mean, I get up in the morning, and I look at the closet, and I'm like, yeah, let's go with that. I mean, if you ask me, what outfit are you going to be wearing next Wednesday? I think pants and a shirt, but I'm not sure I can get any more specific than that. I mean, some people like to have all the details all worked out. And you know what? Sometimes God calls us to do things without giving us all the details mapped out. And sometimes that can really freak us out. Sometimes God calls us to take steps and we really don't know where the final destination is going to be. All we know is where we're supposed to put our next foot tomorrow. And that's what God is calling Philip to do. And you know what? It amazes me that with that amount of information, Philip gets up and goes. He goes out to this deserted place in the middle of the desert. He's out there on the highway from Jerusalem to Gaza, thinking, this is crazy. I don't even know if I'm in the right place. I don't know if this is where God wants me. And all of a sudden, he sees this cloud of dust in the distance. Somebody's coming along this road. Interesting. As he gets closer, he starts noticing that it must be somebody important. I mean, it's kind of a large vehicle that's coming, and they're probably people surrounding it, you know, some indicating that somebody of importance is here. Now, Luke gives us this little, you know, detail that obviously Philip doesn't know. So we're kind of ahead of the game here. So, all right, everyone, Philip doesn't know this, but we know this. All right, so we read this. And there was an Ethiopian, by the way, Ethiopia is like 2,000 miles away from where Philip was living in Jerusalem. I mean, just think about that for a second. You know, here's somebody from 2,000 miles away. That takes us way down into like Central America. That reality that for us is kind of like a different world. Like, you know, we don't even understand things that those people are going through because they're from a world away from us. Here's this Ethiopian coming. A eunuch. Well, that's an interesting detail that Luke throws into the text. All right, so we know something, you know, about his nationality. We know something about his physical condition. A court official of Candace, The name Candace, it looks like a name, but it's not really a name. It's actually a title, kind of like Pharaoh. So this is an Ethiopian queen. And in fact, there were many queens that had this title, Candace. So we're talking about an Ethiopian, a eunuch, a court official. All right, so now we've got his occupation, right? His general occupation, who was in charge of all her treasure. So now we've got his actual responsibility. He handles all of the money that goes through the Queen of Ethiopia's coffers. What do you think? Is that a little bit of money or is that a lot of money? I'm guessing it's on the lot side, right? So this is why I say, I mean, there must have been kind of a really fancy, like, procession. There must have been men around him. I doubt he was traveling with all of the queen's money. All right, so it's not, don't think like Robin Hood is going to attack here or something. But I'm sure that there was an escort that went with this. And he sees all this. In fact, Luke mentions another fact that we don't necessarily, I mean, there's no way Philip could have known this. The guy is coming from Jerusalem. Okay, well, Philip could have known that because anybody coming the road this direction, it's a pretty good guess that they started in Jerusalem. But then he mentions that he was reading. So there's no way Philip could have known that as he sees this procession coming towards him. He just looks at this very important person, and then he hears, once again, an indication from the Spirit. All right, remember, last time he heard an indication, it said, rise and go. And he rose and went. Even though it was taking him out of his comfort zone, even though it was asking him to really trust, because he didn't have all the facts on the table about exactly where he was going. And now all of a sudden he gets another indication. And this indication says, the Spirit said to Philip, go over and join this chariot. Now just think about that for a minute. All right, just put yourself in this scenario. Imagine it for a minute. You're on the highway, right? You're standing on the highway. Okay, you know, I'm here, God. I'm not sure where I'm supposed to be on this highway. All of a sudden, here comes this important vehicle, and it's somebody really important in the center of this whole thing, and I'm sure there was some sort of, you know, escort going with it, and God says, go over and get near those people. Are you understanding what I'm understanding when I look at this story? Okay, I am an expert excuse maker. Anybody else good at that? Anybody else? Yeah. I mean, I don't know. God really made us with this incredible capacity. I can think of excuses for anything. I mean, you name it. I say, oh, you know, well, there are some good reasons that I shouldn't do that. What are they? Well, let me get my thoughts together, but I'm sure I can come up with at least 200 or 250. I mean, can you imagine? You know, like Philip just goes up to this fancy car with this escort. I mean, if I were the Ethiopian eunuch and I saw some guy running towards me, I would be a little nervous. I'd be like, somebody head him off before he gets too close to us. And yet, Philip does it. Philip does it. Philip doesn't make excuses like, God, let me explain the cultural situation here. I don't think this is going to be well viewed in the culture. You know, people just don't do that in this culture. Maybe if you could talk to him and tell him, you know, to stop by and pick me up, that might be a little bit more culturally, you know, acceptable. For God says, go and get close to that guy. Okay? And so Philip runs, and he runs up, and he gets up to this guy's, I say car, but, you know, you know what I'm talking about, right? So he's up to the chariot right there, and he's running along. And as he gets closer, he hears this guy reading, and this guy is reading. Now, we assume the guy is reading in Hebrew. That would seem to make sense. He's just gone to Jerusalem. He definitely has contacts with the Jewish nation. He seems to be reading in Hebrew. Philip hears this guy reading, but as he's running, he notices that he's reading, and he says, wait a minute, I know that passage. Wait a minute. That's the prophet Isaiah. Once again, Luke sort of, you know, let us in on the secret and told us that he was reading Isaiah. But, you know, Philip doesn't find out till he actually is running next to the chariot, and he hears the guy reading Isaiah. In fact, he's not just reading anywhere in Isaiah. He's reading in the middle of Isaiah chapter 53. That is the crown jewel of all messianic texts in the Old Testament. I don't know if that's a true fact, but that's the way I always say it. So if there is another crown jewel, you can tell me about it later. But I mean, if you say, what is the ideal messianic text in the Old Testament? I would answer without a heartbeat, Isaiah 52 and 53. And he gets up and he's running next to this guy and he says, he's reading Isaiah 53. And so Philip asks this incredible question. It's the same question I asked just a few minutes ago. Do you understand what you're reading? Now, to be fair, I was pretty deceitful when I did that, right? That was not fair that I gave him a text that he wasn't expecting. But, you know, the eunuch is reading Hebrew. That's pretty good. I'm sure that he knew enough Hebrew that he was reading it well. Interesting. That could have been an offensive question, right? I just imagine this, right? This eunuch looking down at this guy who's running next to you and saying, excuse me? Do you have a problem with my accent? Do I not sound like I know what I'm reading? But how does the eunuch answer? How can I understand unless somebody explains it to me? And I, that moment where I imagine Philip running along saying, I would love to explain it to you, but not while I'm running. And the eunuch says, you want to step up here and explain this to me? Remember where we started this whole thing? Divine orchestration. When God puts things together in a way that only God can do. That's what this story is about. God takes Philip from the middle of a revival down to the desert to run alongside of an Ethiopian civil servant who is the one who takes care of the queen's treasure, who's reading Isaiah 53, and he's saying, I'm not quite sure I really understand what's going on here. Could you imagine a better scenario? Can you imagine a more ideal moment in time to announce the gospel of Jesus Christ to a person? I can't. I can't imagine how anybody could have organized that series of events in any way that would have been any better than what God put together there. And I look at this story, and I'm amazed at the beauty of it. You know, so Philip steps up into the chariot, catches his breath because he's out of breath after running next to the chariot, and then he starts from this passage. He says, all right, let's go back a couple verses because you're going to have to understand this. So you see, this is not Isaiah talking. And in fact, this is not Isaiah who's talking about Cyrus, which in one part of the message, yes, he is God's anointed one. This is not talking about Israel, who was supposed to be God's anointed one and had failed. This is God's promised anointed one. In fact, this is the one who came and he lived in Jerusalem. Where you just were, that's where this anointed one came. And you know what? Just like this passage prophesied, he was hung on a cross and crucified. But you know why? It wasn't just because those Jewish leaders managed to catch him at a moment where he wasn't quite expecting them. It wasn't that at all. Actually, what it was he was wounded for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. And the chastisement of our peace was upon him. And he starts explaining the gospel to this man, to the point where this man all of a sudden says, wait a minute, hold on. There's some water there. Why can't I get baptized? I mean, this is the moment where this man has, his eyes have been opened and he understands the message of Jesus Christ. And he says, I want to believe in him too. And here's Philip saying, and to think that I almost wanted to stay in Samaria. What a disaster that would have been if I had stayed in Samaria. I would have missed the greatest opportunity of my life. And he stops the chariot. And he and Philip go down into the water, and Philip baptizes him. And this man, he comes out of the water a new creature, not because the water saves him, but because he's placed his faith in Jesus Christ. And when he comes out of the water, he looks around, and Philip's gone. Oh, God has such a sense of humor. He doesn't say, okay, Philip, arise and go. He says, this time I'll take you out of this. And he just drops him out on the road up to where he was supposed to go. And this guy says, man, I would have loved to talk to him. In fact, I think Philip says, you know what? I didn't even get his name. Because that's the one thing we don't get in this story. We found out all this information about the guy, and we didn't even get his name. But you know what? It's not important that Philip didn't get his name, because God got his name, and his name was written down in the Lamb's Book of Life. And the man goes on the road rejoicing as he went, no longer confused about what in the world is this passage talking about. He's going along the road saying, wow, I have understood something that I've never understood, and it's brought a change in my life. My life is different. Now, as I look at this story, I'm not suggesting that God is going to take us down to I-85 somewhere in between Atlanta and Charlotte, and we're going to see a really fancy car going by, and we're going to try to run and keep up with it and see if they're reading the book of Isaiah. That's kind of rough on 85, all right? But what I am saying is there are moments in all of our lives where we have a Jonah moment, and God says, get up and go. Get up and go. It may not be across the world. You know, sometimes when we preach about missions, that seems to be the automatic place, you know, that we take missions. And certainly, if God is working in your heart today and working about getting up and going across the world, let's talk about that. But not everybody can get up and go across the world. Some people need to get up and go across town. Some people need to get up and go across the street. And you know what those rise and go moments? There's going to be a temptation to sort of, you know, hold back and say, wait a minute, God, I'm not sure that would be very good for me. You know, I'm kind of in a good spot here, and I don't know, that might mess things up if I went and did that. And I look at the story and I say, you're in danger of missing God's divinely orchestrated moments if you're not willing to obey Him, to get up and obey His commandments and get out of your comfort zone. In fact, sometimes God may say, arise and go, and we may find ourselves saying, God, I need you to lay out a little bit more details. I need you to work out like a 5-year plan, 10-year plan, 20-year plan. I need to know exactly where things are coming from. You know, we are in danger of missing divinely orchestrated moments because we're too concerned about getting all the explanations when God has given us enough information for us to start obeying already. In fact, sometimes God says, arise and go, and we've already got all our excuses in line. We start pulling them out. Well, God, you know, I would love to do that, but, you know, you know, you may not be aware of this, but trust me, God's aware of it. And if God is saying, arise and go, what do you need to do? Get up and go. It's pretty simple. And what it all boils down to is a question of autonomy. Do we use that word? Who's in control? That was a great answer. But unfortunately, a lot of times, it's not the real reality. Unfortunately, a lot of times, we want to be the ones that are in control. We kind of play with some of these things sometimes, right? Sometimes people talk to me and they say, hey, do you have plans for next week? I say, well, let me think about that. And then what do? I go in and talk to my wife. Who's in control? Well, when we talk about social schedules, it's really good that we can have some teamwork here because she's way better than I am at organizing things. And so, you know, sometimes we play with these things like, you know, oh, yes, you know, my husband's the one who's in control. Meanwhile, the wife is the one that's, you know, moving all the strings. Or we say, my wife makes all the decisions, but that's not true because the husband's the one who's saying, no, we're not going to do that. I don't feel like doing that. Sometimes we play the same game with God. Oh, yes, 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 God's in control. But the truth is, we actually only do what God wants us to do if we like the idea or not. And this is something built into human nature. Kids do it all the time, right? Kids want to know, why do I have to do that? Why do I have to go to school? You guys heard that story about the mother comes in the room and says, it's time to get up, honey. School starts in 15 minutes. He says, I don't want to go. You have to go. Why do I have to go? Because you're the principal. Sometimes we play that game with God and we want to hold the last vote. God says, arise and go. We say, well, explain it to me, and if I like the plan, I'll do it. You know what? God doesn't work that way. And I read this story, and I think it's not just about who's in control at the end of the day. It's about the beauty of actually being a part of God's divine orchestration in this world and having the experience of seeing God work and finding yourself in the middle of it and saying, wow, God, thank you for allowing me to have a tiny part in your incredible plan that you're carrying out in this world. And the thought of missing that because I'm too comfortable, because I've got my reasons, because I've got my excuses, what a shame that we as believers could actually miss out on the opportunity. You know, I'm not trying to say that if Philip hadn't gone that day, that the eunuch would have never heard the gospel. You know, the eunuch had the book of Isaiah. And I have the feeling that if Philip hadn't been obedient, God's Spirit would have opened his eyes and he would have understood the truths of the Word. But you know who would have really missed out that day if Philip hadn't been obedient? It would have been Philip. Philip would have missed his opportunity to have the incredible position in the middle of God's amazing orchestration of plans. And we'd miss out on this incredible story that encourages us to be obedient to what God is calling us to do. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I thank you so much for your word. Lord, I thank you as well that you are so gracious that you reach out to us with this opportunity. You call us. You call us to arise and go. Sometimes just across the street, other times across the nation, other times across the world, in order to be used by you as a part of your incredible plan. Father, I thank you for the opportunity that you give us to serve you. We have no merit in and of ourselves. But Lord, may we be obedient to your will. I pray that we would never miss out on the incredible blessing of serving you. Lord, you know each person in this room. You know those who are feeling right now the conviction of your Holy Spirit on their hearts about whatever it may be. Lord, I pray that each one of us would be obedient to your will and that you would be greatly glorified as we serve you with our lives. I pray this now in Christ's name. Amen.